This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Helen, with you and an all-star lineup of guests for your listening pleasures. Starting with Steve Cronin, independent financial coach from Dead Simple Saving. As we were answering your questions and looking behind the headlines, where can we safely invest and indeed stash our cash, especially in light of the spate of scammers? He shared his expert insights. Talk travel with Emily Baxter about visa-free countries for UAE residents to visit this summer. So if you do need a Schengen visa, you might be in a pretty long queue. So where is visa-free or visa on arrival? Prepare to feel inspired. We also spoke about the benefits of singing with an incredible soprano. Melissa Alder has performed all over the world. She's now here in Dubai and looking to inspire others through breathwork and training. It's not a choir, and she's very keen to get you singing, moving, and learning. Plus, summer camps rounded up. The cool and the creative, from Ski Dubai to heading to a sewing machine. Definitely one for your kids. Joining us in studio, we have got the fantastic Steve Cronin of Dead Simple Saving, independent finance coach, and I have to say, one of the busiest and most in-demand people I think I know. How are you, Steve?
I'm very well, happy to be in the studio.
Good to have you with us. Now, as I said, endless messages coming in for you across all different platforms all the time. So what can we help people with in this next hour? What can we invite people to get in touch with?
I think anything related to personal finance. Finance is one of the top three stressors that we have in the world, and we don't really have any outlet to talk about it. And we don't know where to find the right information because there's loads of rubbish information out there. So we're going to reduce your stress by answering your money questions today. There's no such thing as a stupid question, so answer away.
I was about to say the exact same thing. Whether you're seeking clarity on a particular, you know, term or kind of quote-unquote jargon, or you do want some kind of specific info on what you're going through, what you're worrying about, what you're weighing up, do reach out. Because I feel like, you know, there is a bit, still a bit of stigma and discomfort about talking about money. And I was with some friends the other night and I was like, God, it's an interesting thing that I think maybe men do more than women. I wouldn't really cross my mind to sit down with friends and be like, so what's working for you? What have you got where? You know, what are you thinking about short term, long term? We just don't. And I think that's actually to the detriment of our knowledge, really, about what can work and why I think, you know, the Facebook group is incredibly popular.
Yes, it can be embarrassing to talk about money, especially if you're having money problems, although that's when it's like health, it's like relationships. These are very psychological problems and they're a bit embarrassing. I think the real problem is that couples don't talk to each other about money issues either. And I think it's really important to have transparency, you know, to see what the total income, what the total expenses, what the total debt are. You don't have to control each other's money necessarily, but you should have transparency so that there are no nasty surprises lurking there.
And would you say it's ever too late to have that conversation? Because there might be couples listening today who say, well, you know, at what point do you start talking about what debt you have or how much you earn? You know, when you're dating, when do you start to have those big money chats?
It's never too late, because as you go through your life cycle together, there's always going to be new challenges. So obviously, you don't want to marry someone and then discover they've got like $500,000 worth of debt or whatever. But nor do you on the first date want to say like, oh, do you have any debt problems? So that's a bit intense.
Okay. Somewhere in the middle. Yeah. 4001 with any questions for Steve Cronin. You can use the ARN Play app. If you want to give us a call, great opportunity to pick his brain on the phone on 0487155500. Question I want to put to you, and I'm wondering if you're surprised by this or not. In the news just yesterday, a new report out of Bristol University saying saving money regularly can help improve sleep, right? And I was like, this is not a surprise to me. What was interesting was putting a monthly amount aside, even if it's a small sum, helps people relax and be more optimistic about the future. Regular savers on low incomes have similar life satisfaction levels as rich non-savers, they say. I can well believe that. If you feel like you're taking a small step to empower yourself and look after your future, absolute no-brainer.
Yeah, it comes down to the definition of rich. There are people with high salaries who have high debt and high expenses. Mm-hmm. So we all know people who earn 80,000 dirhams a month and spend 79,000 dirhams. They are much worse off than someone who earns 5,000 dirhams and spends 2,000 dirhams. They're mm-hmm. actually three times worse off. Mm-hmm. So it's really about the gap between your income and your expenses. How much can you save every month? And if that gap's small, you have to do whatever you can without being miserable and living on rice mm-hmm. to actually increase that gap.
Can I ask you, Steve, whether it is through coaching that you're doing with people, obviously people contacting you direct, what are some of the big pain points right now? What are people, are you noticing any patterns in terms of some of the questions that are coming in? Because I'm sure that will reflect what's coming in on 4001 today.
Yeah, I look at three categories. There's planning, there's saving, and there's investing. And each has its own unique pain points.
What about debt?
saving and debt, okay. It's kind of like, and cash, they're kind of all on that. So the planning, like the looking forward to the future, I think people just don't tend to do it. They're so stuck in the today. The sun's always shining, and so you don't think about the future. If you're an expat, you have to create some kind of pension equivalent, because otherwise you have nothing, right? You have to have assets in your future that will generate income for your retirement. So people get stressed when they don't, also because they don't know how long they're going to be here, right?
It is that kind of intangible thing. And yeah. I think there is, especially in the first few years for a lot of people, this idea of like, it's like monopoly money, or, you know, we should enjoy ourselves while we're here. And then next thing you know, it's been 15 years and you haven't saved a dirham.
Yeah, at some point you have to reach financial maturity as an expat, which is like, okay, I'm living in a tax-free country, I'm going to have to save some money. Mm-hmm. The next bit is also difficult, because that's where you actually have to do something about it, which is saving, managing your cash, managing your debt, good debt, bad debt, you know, expensive debt, having enough cash, but not having too much cash.
That problem. Why can't we have too much cash?
Because people have, and you may sleep very soundly now if you have a lot of cash in the bank. I call these people dragons, right? You're sitting on a big pile of cash and gold and you feel really good when you see all those zeros in the bank. And now, yeah, you know, with WeO Bank, you're making 5% or whatever. That's great, but that's not going to last forever. Mm-hmm. And while you might be comfortable now, you're not going to be comfortable in the future, because you've actually got to invest that money in something to generate assets. And the most dangerous of all is if you have that money sitting in your current account earning zero, not only is it getting eaten by inflation, but it can get hacked, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, the tipping point is that choice to educate yourself to then get into the next stage, which is investing. And I think an awful lot of people are completely overwhelmed by jargon, by so-called experts, by people selling products, by paralysis of choice, I think. So what would you say to someone who maybe they are a bit of a dragon and they do find that comfort? And, you know, we can talk about the psychology of money, you know, all day, but for whatever reason, they love having that sum in an account and they know that it could be doing more for them and they know it should be part of their long-term plan, but they don't know what to do next. What's the first step on that road to investments?
I think, firstly, you need motivation to do something about it. So you have to think, like, how much would be enough for me to retire on? Is it $2,000 in Bali? Is it $5,000 in Europe? Is it $10,000 in New York or whatever? Then where's that money going to come from? It's got to come from somewhere. That regular monthly income to cover your retirement expenses, it's either going to come realistically from stocks and bonds or buy-to-let real estate, investment real estate. So what mix of those two do you want? Then you work back from there. Well, okay, I have to get good at that stuff now. Mm-hmm. So how do I learn about stocks and bonds? How do I learn about buy-to-let real estate? Stock and bond investing, which is kind of what I specialize in, I guess, it's surprisingly easy, right? These days, it's very easy. But like, not many people want you to know this because they want to manage your money,
exactly.
Right? And take fees. So like, you can buy a global stock fund that covers like 3,500 stocks in the world. And you can get an international brokerage account like Interactive Brokers, Sawa, Saxo Bank, SwissQuote. And then you just buy the same fund every single month for the rest of your working life. Maybe get a bond fund as well for a bit of downside protection. But when the stock market crashes, that's it.
The thing is, though, it is quite boring. And it should
good.
Be.
Yeah, it's really boring.
Especially if it's automated, especially if you're like, okay, I'm going to put 10% of my account and that's going to be automated on the first of every month and that's going to go into my investment pot. And then I'm actually not going to check on it because hopefully there's not that much to check on.
Yeah, and it's surprisingly easy. And this is why I call my website, you know, Dead Simple Saving, because like, it is simple. And so an hour or two of learning how to do this stuff and a bit of self-belief and I think a bit of ownership, right? Don't rely on your partner. Don't rely on your bank. Don't rely on your financial advisor.
Your parents.
Yeah, or your, especially not your parents or your kids.
No one's coming to save
you. No, just do it yourself and you will feel like a different person.
Let's go to the text line, Steve, because I've had a message here. David's literally just been in touch before the break saying, where to park some cash to earn interest short term? This cash is to cover a property payment later on. Good question.
Yeah, so it depends on the term. I'm going to assume this is like in a year's time or something like that. So anything that has less than a five-year time horizon, you can't put in the stock market because the stock market's very predictable over 10 to 30 years. It's very unpredictable over like 1 to 5 years. So you can't put it in the stock market. So then you don't want it in your current account, obviously, because that's going to be earning nothing. So really a savings account, something like, you know, again, WeBank, 5% interest.
You've got to have a minimum of about 35, I think.
Yeah, which hopefully he has. Yeah, that's true.
Sawa was doing savings, but I think it's slightly less than 5. I think Sawa savings is about 3%, I think.
Yeah.
Anywhere else?
I think there are some expat accounts as well, you know, so like HSBC, Lloyds Bank International, you know, you can get, and not necessarily in dirhams, but you can get decent rates on that. Mm-hmm. So I think anything over 3%, just as high as you can, as long as the bank seems reputable, then that should be okay. You can also look at fixed deposits if you want to, where you may get a bit of extra money, especially if you know you're going to need the money on a certain date.
Okay.
Right. But be careful about fixed deposits because some of them really are fixed, i.e. you can't get the money out for a year or there's a big interest rate penalty if you do get them out.
Hope that helps, David. All the very best with the property. We've also had a message here from Arno saying, hi guys, I'm 28, one kid, I'm earning 40 to 45,000 a month. My plan is to start investing for my child by contributing at least 1,000 dirhams monthly, but where should I put it? So that's interesting, tying into that kind of long-term versus short-term. Could stocks be an option for Arno? I mean, you're a father. What are you doing?
Yeah, absolutely.
You confessed last time you started saving for your for the next generation before you'd even met your partner, I think.
Yeah, so in 2002, I started investing this pot of money in the UK and it just kind of grew there. And eventually I decided that this was going to be my children's education fund.
Oh, would you like to adopt me?
Or your kids. I think definitely you can put the money in the stock market. It's so powerful. A child that is zero, you give them, if you can, 50,000 dirhams, dollars, pounds in 60 years time when they're 60, that will be worth $1 million, dirhams, pounds in today's money.
Whoa.
Right? There's serious growth. So 100% stocks. And then you can just put the money wherever you invest your stock funds. Okay. Right? So your brokerage account.
So for example, you wouldn't necessarily need to set up a separate account in their name or would you have a separate account that you'd kind of earmark for them?
It's hard to set up a separate account for minors and generally you cannot as an expat. It's not very easy. So you can set up a sub account in your name, but I find it sometimes easier to just invest in a fund that is similar but slightly different. So if you're investing in the Vanguard FTSE All World Fund, ETF, they can invest in the environmentally sustainable version of that, for example. And it's almost the same. And then you can tell instantly what's yours and what's theirs.
Makes sense. All right. Really hope that helps. Great question, Arno. Sarah's been in touch saying, I've got a question about emergency fund. I've saved it up. I've kept it in cash. However, given inflation, I think it would make more sense to put it somewhere so it can earn some interest, even if it's below inflation level, which is pretty much everything these days, but also be liquid enough in cases of emergencies. What are your suggestions and practices?
Yeah. So an emergency fund has to be available within a week. Right. So that rules out some fixed deposits, definitely rules out the stock market. Just find a high interest savings account. Also, for an extra layer of resilience, I wouldn't have it all in the country where you are resident. And so you can have some back home or you can have some offshore in Jersey or wherever, and then maybe half offshore and half here.
OK. Steve Cronin with us today. Holidays are coming. I wanted to ask you about booking, spending, exchanges as well. Is this something that's been coming up with some clients and questions?
Yeah, lots of people are worried about spending too much money. Set a budget, right? I know it's the most boring thing in the world, but if you just take 2 seconds to think, are we going to spend 1,000, 2,000, 10,000, then you have to prioritize accordingly. If you spend more on the flight, you spend less on the hotel or less on the meals. But I think the big thing is not getting ripped off on exchange rates and on foreign ATM transactions, foreign transactions in general. Be careful when using your debit cards and credit cards overseas, because they can attract, 3% each time can just go. Now, I know various banks have introduced these kind of global travel cards where you can pay in different currencies.
So what, you'd load that up effectively?
Yeah, you can load that up, and then you can, or it can be linked to a current account. And you just put enough money in for the holiday. And then you can spend money on those cards and in major currencies, dollars, euros, pounds, whatever, and then you're much less likely to get ripped off.
What are your kind of practices on holidays? Well, that card sounds great, actually. I'm going to have a bit of a Google that in a minute. But what else do you do?
Yeah, the first thing is to always pay in the local currency. So the latest trip, particularly in Europe, they say, do you want to pay in euros or dirhams? And you think, oh, that'd be very handy paying in dirhams. But then you get massively ripped off on the currency. So always pay in the local currency. That's quite handy. You don't want to be wandering around with big wads of cash as well. That's pretty scary in general.
Have you ever been robbed?
No, amazingly, I haven't, nor have I been pickpocketed, but I've come close and I've seen people have it. I mean, some people have two wallets, right? So you have a kind of joke wallet.
The decoy.
Yeah, so you're like, take this, and you throw the wallet behind them and they turn around and grab that, and then you can run away. And then you can have a money belt or bra or whatever, to be able to secrete some money somewhere that's much more subtle, and then that's better. Also, don't be flapping around with your mobile phone trying to pay something, because people can just grab it.
Yeah. Making me really worry about my holiday, Steve.
The last thing I'd say is we don't get this in the UAE at all, but on ATM machines, they put these card skimmers over the slot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they can read. It reads your card, the magnetic strip on the way in, and then they have a little video that watches your PIN pad. It's very clever as you type the PIN in. So you have to put your fingers over. Holidays are so fun, aren't they?
You
have to
so
put
relaxing.
Your fingers over the PIN pad, and you just have to make sure there's nothing weird sticking on the ATM machine.
Oh, gosh, guys. Any questions for Steve Cronin? We nearly got robbed in Barcelona, but I kind of caught on to what was going on. That we were outside our Airbnb and loads of looked like coffee was being dripped onto our suitcases from the balconies above. So we walked back to try and look up to the balcony, and at that point a guy walked past and dropped some keys on the ground, and I of course was like, oh, here are your keys, and he tried to engage me in conversation, and I realised that someone was squirting coffee out of a syringe to get us away from our suitcases, and then I was in his face and said some expletives. My mum was like, Helen, you're being so rude, and I was like, no, it's a job. I felt like I was crack the code. But
there are locals who make it their job to spot scammers and then shout at them now in tourist locations.
There's a few good Instagram accounts of that. People in Italy just shouting, pickpocket!
Yeah.
Right. Here's something that I've seen a lot of on the Facebook groups recently, Steve. It is people looking to move to Dubai and thinking about how much money do I need to have in the pot to get myself set up. Whether that is, one spouse is earning, the other isn't going to be initially, about school fees, about rents, about furnishing, all that jazz. So what advice would you be giving if your best mate said, I'm going to move to Dubai?
So it depends whether one of you has a job or not. If you don't have a job, you need a lot of money just to survive. But in general, the setup costs are quite high. You need to grill your prospective company as to whether they are going to give you a rent advance, maybe a furniture allowance or whatever. Allowances are kind of slowly disappearing anyway. And so, I would probably say at least 30 to 50,000 dirhams just to make sure that you are okay. I mean, it's scary moving country, right? And if you don't have enough cash. But the second point is that you need to know how to transfer pounds or wherever you're coming from, pounds, euros, into dirhams efficiently. So if you find you don't have enough money, then you can efficiently bring in more without getting ripped off.
Any questions for Steve? Get in touch. Paul saying, what wealth tracking apps do you recommend? If you say Excel.
I'm a bit of an Excel person. So there are wealth tracking apps and then there are kind of budgeting apps. There's one called Kubera. There are all sorts of them out there. I don't particularly have a favorite. You know, there's Mint and things like that. But some of them struggle to connect with UAE banks, for example. Mm-hmm. There's another interesting one called Portfolio Lab that not just tracks your wealth, but also like makes predictions into the future. Not all of these are free. There's one called like Personal Capital. There's lots of them out there. Personally, I think Excel is fine. The more automated ones, though, they're either going to struggle with getting your UAE bank account deposit sizes or your home country. Mm-hmm. So,
the best one's probably the one that is most suited to your needs. You know, in terms of one you're going to. Same with budgeting. If you're going to use it, it's going to be good.
Yeah, most of them have a free trial period or something like that. You just try it out and see the one that you like. The main thing is that you're tracking it.
Would you think about starting your own?
No. No.
All right, just wanted to check.
I don't want to be involved in tech stacks and things like that. I'm busy enough helping people. That's okay. What I want to focus
on. Just curious. No name on this message for you, Steve, saying, hi there, I've got a Saxo Bank account which I'm paying into monthly for planned retirement. When I move back to the UK, if I withdraw 4% per annum in the future, will I be taxed on this and or get taxed on the profits made from the investment? Thank you very much.
So the answer is yes. When you move to the UK, you will be taxed on your worldwide income. Now, there are some wrinkles here because if you are not a UK citizen or you've been out of the country for over 10 years, then in the first 4 years, you may not get taxed on your global income and gains. But this is all changing with the new government. It's only just been mentioned even in 2024. So we actually don't know. But yes, you will get taxed on your dividend income and on your capital gains. The main thing is before you move back, you just sell everything and buy something similar but different or rebuy it 30 days later. And then you won't have any capital gains when you move back.
Good advice, Steve Cronin. Kenneth's been in touch. Kenneth, thank you for saying this. Kenneth says, I feel really stupid asking this, but here goes. I think it's all good questions asked. If I invest in stocks and shares and things aren't going well, I still have the stocks and shares. It's just their value is low, right? I hear people say they lost everything in the stock market. Am I right in thinking that as the market is volatile, it's okay to start my investing journey now as prices can be low, but I can expect dips and eventually they will rise over many years? Or do I actually lose the money and never get it back? Forgive my ignorance. I'm doing a lot of self-education. I'm just teaching myself about building wealth. That's why we're here, Kenneth.
This is a great question. So thank you for asking. And you're absolutely right. If you buy a stock fund and the value goes down during a market crash and you don't do anything, then it will always go back up again. Obviously, like if you buy an individual stock or a specific sector, then it may not go back down. It may not go back up again. And that's why we don't recommend that. But
diversify.
If you buy the whole world, right, then over your time horizon, and remember, your time horizon is until you die, right? It's not even till retirement. It's not until you move home. Your main time horizon is until you die. So you've got decades. It will only go up. When people lose money, it's either because they're investing in specific things or because they're panicking when the market goes down, then they sell, and then they crystallize that loss and they're not getting it back.
Great answer. Great question. Kenneth, thank you so, so much. Steve Cronin is with us this afternoon taking your questions. Apologies to Jennifer Lopez. I think we've got too much to talk about and we might just ditch her, even though the song was My Love Don't Cost a Thing, which I suspect is not true, J-Lo. Aaron saying, hi both. I'm a UA resident and I've got an auto loan in place. I've heard that it's advisable to pay off your debt and set up an emergency fund up to 6 months before investing any money. It seems that that would take a long time to do and I want to start investing as early as possible. What do you think? Can I start investing or should I wait? Does an auto loan even count as debt?
Okay, so you've got three buckets. You've got your investment bucket, you've got your emergency fund, and you've got your debt. And you need to kind of toggle between them. I would start putting in just like $1,000 worth into the stock market to learn how to invest. Then by the time you actually have some money to invest, seriously, you will know what you're doing.
Okay.
Debt, if you have expensive debt, which is above 5% in US dollar terms and likely to stay above 5% in the next couple of years as rates go down, then I would pay it off. If not, auto loans tend to be quite cheap. There's no hurry to pay it off whatsoever. There's nothing wrong with cheap debt whatsoever. Emergency fund, try to have 6 months. Make sure at least you have 1 to 3 months total expenses as your emergency fund. So that's how I would balance it.
Makes sense. All right. Great question, Aaron. Thank you for that. It's the big question right now, and we were just chatting about it off air. The decision to buy a property, especially in Dubai. What kind of questions do you advise people ask themselves and indeed their partners when it comes to making that decision as an expat in particular?
So it depends whether you want to buy a property to live in or to rent out. And you then need to think about how long are you going to be in the country, ideally 7 to 10 years before you even think about buying property, or that the place is rentable and that if you had to suddenly go back to your home country, you could at least keep this property and rent it out. Mm-hmm. Because Dubai property markets are quite volatile. I mean, hopefully they're getting better, but they do go up and down. There's some big peaks, 2007, 2014, and now. Mm-hmm. And so, and then they go down. They can go down 30, 50% in value. So it's a bit of a roller coaster. But again, if you've got a long time horizon, then that doesn't matter. Then you have to think about getting a mortgage. Like, can you save enough money for a deposit? Do you have enough cash? And then do you have enough for a mortgage? Is your job stable? Do you like your job? Are you at risk of getting fired? And because having that mortgage can be a bit of a millstone around your neck, mm-hmm. if you run into financial problems.
It's interesting, isn't it? I think culturally it's quite... I find it quite fascinating in terms of which countries, which cultures kind of fetishize this idea of property ownership, because that was always the thing for me growing up. It was very much idealized of, you're only really secure until you buy a property. And then I think it was Ramit Sethi's book about, I Will Teach You to Be Rich, and which I really enjoy. And I think for anyone who is looking to kind of do some basic reading into personal finance, I would really recommend it. And he doesn't own a property. And he's like, well, it doesn't make financial sense to me in the life I have right now. And I think it's quite, it's got to be right for you for the right reasons.
Yeah, if you want flexibility, then rent. If you want stability, then buy a property.
Steve Cronin, to the text line we go. We had a message anonymous earlier, which is absolutely A-OK. You don't need to put your name on anything. Saying, need some help/advice, please. My husband has saved an amount of 20,000 dirhams and he's asked me for my opinion. Should he invest it or pay off debt first? Unfortunately, his debt is 70,000 dirham credit card plus a loan. I know what I would do.
Yeah, so it depends on the interest rate on the debt. It sounds like it's high. So personal loans likely to be 7% or something like that. You can only make 7% long-term average in the stock market, really. So pay off that loan. Credit card debt is like 40%. So absolutely never build up credit card debt. Always try and pay it off every single month. If you can't do it, absolutely throw all your money at that credit card debt, because you're not going to be making 40% in the stock market or even the Bitcoin market, frankly.
I made some credit card mistakes in the past.
And now, we've all made mistakes.
And now I just don't have one. Which I think is a bit of a misstep, to be honest, because there's so many people do it and do it well. And maybe now that I'm older, I wouldn't make the same mistakes and I would be more disciplined at paying off and getting points. And, I see friends being like, we got this hotel stay for free and these flights are on points. And I'm like, I've just been burned too much.
I think there's a really important topical point here, which is that there's a massive increase in card scams at the moment. And if you're paying with your debit card, it's vulnerable because that's the key to your current account. So, and your current account can get cleaned out. So I would advise anybody really, or I'd recommend, get a credit card. Time to be an adult.
Look at me like that.
Get those points. But also, because I don't think you should use your debit card for anything other than the ATM machine.
Ooh, even my little, drink downstairs before the show.
Nope. No. Credit card on everything. It makes it much easier to track everything, but it's also much safer because it's not your, if there's a scam, and there's a lot of scam, it's exploded in the past month. OTP scams, all sorts of things. People are just waking up and finding like there's been 5 foreign transactions on their account overnight. And so I wouldn't even keep your debit card on Apple Pay, Google Pay, Samsung Pay, or anything like that. I would just use a credit card.
Well,
pay it off every day, pay it off every week, pay it off every month, just pay it off.
All right, another thing for the to-do list. Right, last question. Chris saying, looking for some advice for our maid. She's from the Philippines. She tends to send all of her salary home, but we're paying her more than her last employer. And she wants to be a bit more responsible with the money and save that extra cash. Are there savings accounts available to her in the UAE? Could she potentially invest? She wants to buy property at some point.
Yes, I think it would be good for her to build up some cash savings in the UAE. If she sends the money home, who knows what's happening to it, right? Possibly
big
getting
problem.
Spent, right?
Yeah.
So yes, you should be able to open a bank account, or you can even open a bank account in her name, right? Until she goes home. These days with investing even, you can start investing with, I think CBD or SAWA, the minimums are very low. And so it may not be super efficient, but you can start, with $100 or something like that. And then you learn how to invest. And that's a great skill to have.
I want to ask you about platforms, because using SAWA as an example, which is one that I actually do use, but it's quite hard to know when to trust a platform, especially when they're new to the market and you necessarily haven't got that kind of tried and trusted legacy. What kind of research should be doing? What kind of questions should be asking before you either move money onto a new platform or you start investing for the first time on one?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I just wouldn't use a new platform. that's a bit tough, but I think you don't need to. If we're talking about investing, be very, very careful about crypto platforms, because we've seen from FTX, they can completely blow up. Mm-hmm. Lots of them are having problems.
Great headlines, though.
Yeah, great headlines.
Fun to read about,
yeah,
from the outside.
Not to be invested in. And then from investing platforms, we know that like SAWA's back end is Saxo Bank, right, which has a good reputation, and SAWA has built up their reputation as well over 5 years. And you can read on their website how your money is protected. Mm-hmm. What happens if SAWA goes bust? What happens if Saxo Bank goes bust? Who's protecting you? But in general, the international brokerages, they're not in this country. So I'd say this with any country: you don't want everything in one country. No matter how much you love your country, right, is like diversified, that gives you resilience. And secondly, like these big international brokerages have been around for decades, mm-hmm. and they're very well capitalized, they're secure, they're not going anywhere. Whereas something that's just popped up in the past year, or something that's linked to your bank, right, like you've got a lot of money deposited in cash in your bank, you don't want to have all your stocks with
the
same bank
place
as well.
Last question, any recommended reading, podcasts, books that you're really enjoying right now, or for anyone that might be starting on their, personal finance education journey? I've already given you my Sethi recommendation. What about you?
Yeah, Die with Zero is really interesting. And then good old Andrew Hallam, Millionaire Expat, but the third edition where he talks about low-cost living in different countries.
Fantastic.
That's really good.
Steve Cronin, and just contact you, whether that is for coaching, workshops you're going to be doing after the summer, or of course, massive resources on your website, LinkedIn and more. How best to get in touch?
Yeah, so deadsimplesaving.com or deadsimplesaving on Instagram. Lots of free information there.
I'm just off to research what credit cards I can get. Luckily, I've got a man in the studio telling me exactly which one to get. Note to self, Helen, pay it off every single month this time. Go on, be a grown up. Baxter in the studio, travel journalist. She's been working for decades in media, print, and digital, talking travel, luxury, and off the beaten track as well. You're not all luxury, which is why I'm glad you're here today, because we're talking about where you can go. A lot of UA residents struggling to get Schengen visa or facing mega, mega delays. So what's trending right now, Emily Baxter? Where do you feel like a lot of people are going to? What are you hearing more and more about? What's going on in travel land?
I think, as you said, it's the kind of off the beaten track countries and cities that people are looking to kind of get a bit of a break away from the sort of gorgeous lifestyle that perhaps Dubai offers you, with the kind of gorgeous skyscrapers and the five-star living.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I have to be very careful when I say this. If I was living back in the UK and my, annual holiday was, you've got 2 weeks and you want to go somewhere where you're basically going to get a suntan, because that's a big part of why you go away. Mm-hmm. You want to get your kind of annual vitamin D injection. Then there's massive pressure to go somewhere sunny.
Yeah.
And you really want the weather to be amazing so you can, do this or do that or do nothing. Whereas here, you can feasibly be at the beach every weekend, which means I feel like it's actually quite liberating because it means that your criteria for a holiday is maybe a little bit different. So Steve Cronin, that was just in the studio there, he was saying he's going to Slovenia this year, which is where I went last year. He was talking about Kyrgyzstan, about going to Poland. And now we're lucky enough that we've actually got some pretty, you know, reasonable ways of getting to, as you say, kind of off the beaten track destinations. So the Schengen visa situation.
Yeah.
Who is this affecting?
I mean, it's affecting anybody who is trying to travel to, you know, one of the 29 countries within the Schengen state. And what, I think...
Why the delays, though?
I think it's just a backlog. I think, you know... If you've been reading the news recently, especially with the Euros and the Taylor Swift Eras tour, lots of people have been missing out. You know, they've booked their tickets and now they're plane tickets as well as their tickets to, you know, matches or to the concert. And they're now having to actually sell their tickets because they haven't been able to get visas on time.
If anyone's got any Taylor Swift tickets, 4001.
Two, please.
Two. Should we take the kids?
No.
Me and Emily want your Taylor tickets.
And I think it's just a backlog. I mean, they say on average you need sort of between 15 to 30 days to apply for a Schengen visa. However, having spoken to lots of friends of mine who have been trying to travel over the Eid break and also kind of book ahead for the summer holidays, whether it's, you know, June, July or August, they just haven't been able to get appointments at all. Mm. So, you know, exactly as you say, now it's kind of looking, you know, those people I mentioned who haven't been able to get to the places they wanted to go to are now having to think, you know, kind of out of the box.
But creatively, which is why we're here.
Yeah, exactly.
We're not just here with problems. We're here with solutions. So we're looking at visa-free destinations. And Georgia is top of your list. Have you been?
I did. I went, I think, two summers ago. I was actually due to go for Eid al-Fitr and my daughter got COVID at the time, which was... one of those sort of secret silent blessings, because the week we were meant to go, it was meant to be pouring with rain. And we ended up going later in the summer. And it was absolutely stunning weather. We spent 3 days in Tbilisi. And then we did 4 nights at a place called La Potta Lake Resort, which is, as it sounds, it's centered around a lake. And it's in the Kaheti region. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Any Georgians out there, let us know.
which is a sort of grape region. And it's just, it was one of the most beautiful places.
Oh, it's laughably beautiful. It was a screensaver.
It was, you know, we did pedaloing around the lake. There were horses, there were goats, there was, you know, there's a castle. There was just, you know, everything you want. And as you say, what I look for in a summer break is very different here. I don't mind if it rains, but all I really want is greenery.
Me too.
I need plants. I need nature. I want to be outside pretty much 24/7. So to be able to have that, but then also combine it with Tbilisi at the end. So where we went was 2 hours, I think, north of Tbilisi. And then the 3 days at Tbilisi at the end, which was just a fantastic city.
Oh.
It's incredibly cool. Sort of rustic, but also, you know, some you know, modern areas, the old town, the old part of the city.
Super reasonable as well.
Yeah, it was. It was. And, you know, they've got some very kind of cool boutique hotels. They've got, you know, the Radissons and the Hiltons and the Marriotts. So there really is kind of something for every kind of budget and whatever you're looking for.
I want to go back. I went with friends probably two summers ago. Mm. We went to climb a glacier.
Yeah, as you do.
As you do. about 3 hours out of Tbilisi. And we didn't summit because the weather was actually really bad. Mm-hmm. It was really, really bad. So we had an extra kind of bonus 2 nights in Tbilisi. And I completely, completely fell in love with the city.
Yeah.
Amazing food and pairings. And walking around. Loved the cable car.
Yes.
Just loved it. So Georgia, no visa, and then you could stay 90 days, I think.
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
And now, we are going to talk now about Azerbaijan, because I feel like that's somewhere that a lot of people are saying, oh, I had a great long weekend in Azerbaijan. Mm-hmm. Have you been to Azerbaijan yet? Oh, and I'm like, no, I don't.
Yeah.
I'll be completely honest. I think I would struggle to point to it on a map, which is a massive sign of my ignorance and how much I'm missing out on this. Have you been? Do you know when it's been? What's the deal with visas?
So I have not been, but I have written about it many times. And it's very, very high up on my list. I don't know if it would necessarily be where I would go for a long summer holiday, but I think for a really fantastic spring, summer or autumn kind of long weekend break, I think it really offers something for everyone. So it has a visa on arrival, which you can have, which allows you 30 days. I guess you'd probably most likely fly into Baku. And again, as a city, it's just incredibly cool. There's so much to see and do. It's got like, you know, a really kind of thriving energy. They have a carpet museum, which is actually designed a bit like the Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Library here, which is designed like a book. The carpet museum is designed like a carpet, a rolled up carpet. They have Little Venice, where they have all the canals. There's the old city. There's a very famous flame tower. So you can spend, you know, a really good few days there, but then you can also leave the city and go to lots of different little towns and villages. They have the Shamakai, again, I hope I pronounced that correctly, where there's a safari park, an alpaca farm and an observatory. There's an area called Gobustan, which has this incredible rock art. They have the Caucasus Mountains, where obviously in the winter you can ski, but in the summer you can go hiking and camping.
Oh, okay.
I got you?
Yeah. I'm actually just Googling Baku weather.
So we might see each other there soon.
We might see each other. Emily Baxter with us in the studio, sorting out your travel dilemmas. We're talking about, in particular, those who aren't able to get that Schengen visa over the summer. We're seeking some sun next. Maldives, Thailand, Nepal, what do you need to know and what should you do when you get there? Joining us in studio to talk visa-free travel, we've got travel journalist Emily Baxter. We've been to Georgia, we've dipped our toe into Azerbaijan, and a message from Grace saying, how about Montenegro? It's on my list. In fact, Steve Cronin, who was just here earlier, saying how much he loved it for, you know, the fjords and the, you know, the lakes and the. It looks stunning, and it's increasingly popular with GCC residents. Actually, what's there to do?
I mean, kind of what isn't there to do? I actually haven't been, but I've been to Croatia, and I looked longingly over the border to Montenegro, somewhere that I've wanted to go for a very long time. Again, very much enticed, like you, by the beaches, the fjords, the kind of fortified towns and the churches. The, you know, they have glacial lakes. And, you know, it's, I think, a really wonderful place to go with children, but equally a great place to go with, you know, either a couple or as a solo holiday or to meet your friends.
What's the visa situation?
So there is no visa and you're allowed to go for 90 days. Oh. So UAE residents, there is no visa.
Excellent.
Which is perfect for the summer.
Now, whenever we talk travel, when we think about trends, the most popular destinations seem to be from the UAE, Maldives and Thailand.
Yes.
These are on your list. And for, I mean, there's obvious aesthetic and, you know, luxury reasons why they are such popular destinations. Mm-hmm. But from a practicality point of view, especially Maldives, the flight time is minimal, 4 hours, and there's no visa as well. Mm-hmm. You've written extensively on it as a destination. Yeah. Do you have any standout hotels? And I know we go to different places for different reasons,
yes,
but any recommendations tried and tested?
I mean, I've been very fortunate and stayed in lots of gorgeous hotels.
Oh,
I have to say
that... You can go off people, Emily.
Come back to me.
Come on, make it better.
I have to say that two of my favourites have been Cheval Blanc, which is a very high-end hotel. So definitely one to do if you're feeling a little flush. Mm-hmm. But a spectacular, spectacular resort. And also Suniva Fushi, which is a really beautiful resort. It's barefoot luxury at its finest. It is luxury, but it's really, really pared back luxury, where you almost kind of don't know it's luxury. The staff is incredible. The rooms and just everything about it, you know, they take your shoes on arrival and you don't really see them again until the day you leave if you don't want to.
Wow.
Fantastic for children. And just, you know, very, a huge island, but absolutely filled with trees and nature and, you know, kind of bunnies hopping everywhere and just a gorgeous.
Can I bring it back to the like proper family?
Yes.
Okay. So when we've been, we've always been that kind of, you know, like value first, which I think actually has been a big shift for a lot of people for a long time. The Maldives was like, it is pure honeymoon.
Yep.
You know, you might do a bit of snorkeling, but you're probably just, you know, lounging and holding hands and having sunset walks. There has been a massive shift recently, which is there's this GCC market of people that want to go on an easy family holiday. and the hotels have kind of responded.
Yeah.
So we've been a few times. We've been to Crossroads Maldives, which is on your list as well.
Yeah.
So that's kind of three destinations in one. They've got the Hard Rock, they've got Sai Lagoon, and then Crossroads. And so it's a big island. It's very, very, very close to Male. So you get, actually, the boats that you get in Abu Dhabi, they're kind of like around the coastline. It's those boats that you get. And then that was fab. Really, really, you know, two great kids clubs. You access, you know, loads of food options. We've done Club Med in the Maldives, and more recently went to Candima. So in terms of value, Candima was fantastic. They always seem to have deals on. I think because of the algorithm, I think I saw one the other day which was like 60% off because of seasonality as well.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
What's Maldives weather looking like over the next few weeks and months?
I mean, there is sort of chance of rain, but you know, like in the Maldives, like a lot of the kind of Indian Ocean countries, when it rains, you know, it might pour, but it doesn't last forever.
Yeah.
The sky is always going to turn blue again. And like you were saying at the beginning, you know, when you come from here and it's the summer holidays and it's, you know, 45 degrees, I don't mind a bit of rain.
Same.
In fact, I look forward to feeling a bit of seasonality.
Yep. Okay. So Maldives, no visa. You can stay for 30 days. If you're going for 30 days, tell me your secrets. Now, you're actually heading off to Thailand yourself.
I am, yes.
Again, no visa, 30 days. Where are some of your kind of, huge country, huge diversity depending on the destination. Tell me your top picks for that part of the world.
In terms of hotels?
Hotels, destinations. I've only ever been to Bangkok and I had flu.
Okay.
And I self-medicated with Thai Red Bull and I don't remember anything about that trip.
We probably don't need to go there.
No, we don't.
So, I mean, obviously Bangkok is an incredible place to go. It's, you know, hugely, hugely vibrant.
Sensory overload on the Thai Red Bull.
So. But I think, you know, you've got the street food and you've got the markets and it's sort of a 24/7 sort of city. But I think, I'm heading off to Phuket next week, and Phuket is definitely one of my favorite areas to go. Incredible hotels, again, you know, all kinds of budgets, perfect for families, couples, and otherwise. You can do all the kind of island hopping, whether you do it, you know, over a week or you just do a day trip every now and again. You can go to Krabi, I haven't actually been to Krabi, but one of my other favorite areas is Chiang Mai. Again, a completely different vibe to Bangkok, but also to Phuket and Krabi. It's kind of more inland. It has the rice paddy field, a little bit more cultural. It has the kind of the temples and the wats. So Thailand's the kind of country, it just gives so much. There's just so much to see and do on so many different levels.
I mean, I'll be following your Instagram with interest.
Come.
Come. I think actually...
Bring the kids.
I think we holiday together really well, actually. Don't mind a bit of rain. So Thailand, no visa, 30 days. We've got time, I think, for Nepal, because that's visa on arrival, but 90 days.
Yes.
I went whitewater rafting in Nepal a few years ago, like before having kids. It was a brilliant break because, you know, flying to Kathmandu...
Yeah.
That was actually quite a fun experience because it was lots of like, okay, you bring your picture and this is the moment.
Yeah.
It was like a bit of like a, it was an experience. And then out into the countryside, we did a 4-night whitewater rafting trip. And it was unbelievable. I mean, Mount Everest,
yes,
obviously a big attraction. What else do you think you can do and who do you think would have a great time in Nepal?
So I went... many, many years ago, probably about 10 years ago, and also fell in love. I was, I think, only there for 4 days, and unfortunately, I didn't get to do the whitewater rafting. But one of my favorite things was just the cultural side, to be able to walk around and go to the monkey temple, see all the stupas and the gleaming Buddhas. It just offers such a beautiful contrast to, you know, what we have here. And the people were just phenomenal, just so incredibly friendly. It just feels like a beautiful place to go and have, I guess, a bit of a detox as well, a digital detox. It's not necessarily the place you'd go and want to Instagram about, not because it's not beautiful, but it just kind of takes everything down a notch, a bit more meditative, I'd say.
That sounds dreamy.
It
right
does.
Now.
Yes.
It really does. So visa on arrival, 90 days, Nepal. Where else is on the visa-free list that we haven't got time to kind of delve into just to give people some more ideas? Because I know you've got a quick roundup as well,
yes,
Emily.
Yes, so Kazakhstan is there. Seychelles, which is obviously a very popular destination for UAE residents. Sri Lanka as well, due to quick flight time.
Yeah, my husband's... I keep on saying, my husband's taking the kids to Sri Lanka next week. I'd messaged him before. I was like, I've just realised you're going to be at the airport when England final's
oh,
on.
Oh, how does he feel about that?
Not great.
How do you feel?
Truthfully, I apologise to any massive football fans. I couldn't give a monkeys. I honestly don't care. I feel like football brings out the worst in an awful lot of people. So I am going to be happily asleep come 11 o'clock on Sunday night. So he's taking the kids to Sri Lanka on a very cheap and cheerful surfing camp. Like, amazing. He showed me the hotel and I was like, enjoy that.
Happy you're not going.
Yeah. but, you know, you can, you know, they've had a really, really obviously tough few years and really bouncing back. So Sri Lanka,
Jordan, Armenia, Indonesia, Mauritius. If you do your research, there are lots of places that you can go visa-free or visa on arrival.
Thank you so, so much, Emily. For anyone who wants to follow you, your travels, your work as well, of course, as a travel journalist, what's the best way of finding you online?
Probably through Instagram, which is Emily Baxter Priest.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Enjoy. I will honestly be following your Thailand trip with interest. Isn't it sad that I'm already thinking about holidays for 2025? That's all your fault. Emily Baxter in the studio. Today we have the great pleasure of speaking with Melissa Alder, a classically trained soprano with over 20 years of experience in the industry, and she made her solo debut at the Royal Albert Hall at just 17 years old, studied at the Royal Academy of Music, and her illustrious career saw her perform at some of the world's most iconic venues. She's here in Dubai now and has been recently reflecting on the incredible benefits of singing, realising how it can make her and others feel whole again, and sharing these benefits with us now and then after the summer with Dubai as a whole. How are you, Melissa?
Good afternoon, Helen. Firstly, thank you so much for inviting me in. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. This is a topic I'm really, really passionate about, because I feel like as we get older, we sometimes move away from the things that gave us joy when we were younger. And whether that's through having kids or being busy or kind of belittling them a bit as being silly, whether that's sports or hobbies. And unfortunately, you know, when kids fly the nest or when jobs change, we need to make a real effort to remember who we are. And sometimes going back to things that gave us pleasure when we were younger is an amazing way of reconnecting. And for me, that's singing. I sang not well at all in the school choir, but recently started singing in the parent-teacher choir at my children's school.
Oh, amazing.
And it has been so much fun. Now, your career journey on singing has taken a very, very different route. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and when you first became passionate about it?
So I first became passionate about singing from, I don't actually remember when. I never wanted to do anything else apart from sing, from a tiny, tiny little girl. Aww. And I remember being asked to sing at something when I was 5, and my mum said, she's never going to stand up there and do it. And I did, and I loved it. And from that minute on, that's all I wanted to do. I had amazingly supportive parents. I was very, very lucky.
I think that's really key.
Really key.
Because it's very easy to diminish that. So my brother's a musician, and it would have been very easy for my parents to go, oh, he wants to be a drummer as a way of not doing, you know, working hard on academics. And that wasn't the case. He was exactly the same, so I couldn't imagine doing anything else. But my parents being supportive was the absolute missing piece in that success.
Yeah, and it's so crucial as well, because we'll get onto this later, but the benefits of music in children is absolutely huge. They've done studies on kids that sing in choirs, that play instruments, to whatever level, whether it's just the lunchtime club or they're sort of high flyers at grade 8. The kids that study music to any level achieve better academically. Which is amazing. It's really interesting. So, and we'll talk about all those why later.
We can talk about the whys.
So I was very, very lucky with my parents. I went to a school that was very great, great music department. And then I went, as you said, I went on to study at the Royal Academy of Music. My mother did have a brief moment where she said, What are you going to do as a fallback? And I said, I'm not going to have one.
There's no plan B.
There's no plan B. So it's going to work.
Did you know in what
area of music you wanted to work? Was it like, okay, I'm going to be famous pop star, or was it always going to be about the stage?
That is an interesting question, because I always thought that I would go into musical theatre. I love musical theatre. I'm so passionate about it. I still love it to this day.
Okay, favourite musical?
Les Mis, obviously.
I mean, I would ask you to break out a little bit of I Dreamed a Dream, Susan Boyle style, but you're not warmed up.
Too right.
So it was going to be the West End. That was the goal.
That was what I really thought that I was going to do. And life just takes you on strange turns, doesn't it? And I was taking, I'd done my undergrad at the Academy, and they were starting a music theatre course there. And they said, oh, do stay, we'll support you through and do the music theatre course, it'd be amazing. But it's going to be a year's gap before the course starts. So off I went and go and take a gap year. Great, because I'd gone straight from school to the Academy, so I was going to take a gap year. And I found myself in France working, doing extra chorus for Opera de Lyon. And they were doing La Traviata. And I thought, to begin with, I felt completely out of my comfort zone. I was thinking, this isn't for me, this isn't where my heart is.
These are not my people.
These are not my people. However, after being there for several months, I realised that these were my people, and I had an amazing time. Traviata is still my favourite opera to today.
I wish I had a clip. Milani.
You know what? You need to find the famous moment that's in Pretty Woman. That's the moment when she goes to the opera.
In that dress.
Yeah, in that amazing dress. That's the moment, and that really famous moment from Traviata.
I've just got goosebumps.
Milani, find it.
Milani, fetch me Traviata.
Act two.
There you go, act two. Melissa Alder is with us today, classically trained soprano. So you became that elusive unicorn of working full-time as a singer in London, as I said, performed all over the world. Was there a moment where you thought, I've made it, I'm doing this?
I just think every step of the way, I just loved everything I was doing and just felt so lucky and so blessed that I was, sometimes you go places and people say, what do you do? And I say, well, I'm a singer. And they go, oh, okay. And so what's your proper job? No, that is my job. I'm a singer. They're like, oh, that's really cool.
It is an amazing thing to do.
And it has been, I went, I say, from Opera de Lyon, I then decided, okay, maybe I will go down the opera route, see how it goes. So I went from there to a beautiful little opera house in the UK called Glyndebourne in Sussex, which is amazing, and kind of really did my sort of, I feel like I did my postgraduate studies there, really, learnt on the job, which was amazing.
Can I ask how your voice changed as you got older, Melissa?
Interestingly, it was when I was younger. So when I was younger, I sang as a mezzo soprano. All the way through college, I sang as a mezzo. I started off at Glyndebourne as a mezzo, and then I just one day I was singing. I was singing at an event, and I was singing a quite low piece, and I just felt I got to the end of it, and I thought, I feel like I've sung a marathon, and it was just one aria, and I was thinking, I think things might be changing. And I had an amazing teacher at the time still. She's not here anymore, bless her. Mm. But she was amazing, Mary. And and we just explored a bit. Then I was
transition.
Very, very lucky. I then sort of went to them at Glyndebourne and said, when they, as they keep reissuing the contracts, they were like, here's your mezzo contract. And I was like, but I want to be a soprano now. And they were like, No, we can't do that. You realise how many, all that we're
like
in the...
It's like a 3D jigsaw puzzle.
That's a whole rejig. And I was like, just give me a chance, give me a session. And they did, and I turned into a soprano. I mean, obviously, then I worked on it and worked, but yes, so I went up to a soprano, which is great because they have all the best repertoire.
Well, as someone who sings low, I know. We've got Melissa Alder with us today. She's performed all over the world. My goodness, incredible pedigree. And is now in Dubai. We're talking about the benefits of singing. I want to talk about your journey to Dubai. You moved here during COVID.
That's right.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about what that experience was like and how it's maybe even helped you reconnect with that love of singing now, Melissa?
Absolutely, absolutely. So we talked a little bit about the first part of my journey as a singer. I then was lucky enough to get a job at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden in London. And I worked there for almost 20 years, which was an incredible experience. A crazy job, didn't really fit in with being a mum of three girls. I have three girls. So, yes, I had a very, very, as I said, my parents were very supportive. My mother was amazing, helping me when I was working all the time.
The evening shifts.
Evening shifts.
Every
you know,
evening.
Morning rehearsals, evening shows, you know, crazy, but wonderful. And then COVID hit. Well, just before that, my husband Andy had been invited to do just a year's contract here, set up of Expo, working at Expo. And he said, oh, if I go, then you could take a sabbatical from the Opera House and, you know, our middle daughter was just taking her GCSEs. It was like, okay, this is perfect timing. Okay, let's do that. We'd worked out the whole thing, how we were going to every month, he'd come home or we'd come here, and then COVID hit. Mm-hmm. So he was here about, I don't know, 6 weeks, and then it was COVID. So, and everybody's life's changed there. I don't want to go into it too much. I lost my mother in COVID,
I'm so sorry.
We kind of had a whole rejig about where are we going, what are we doing, and Andy said, I'm just loving it here in Dubai. Let's do it. Shall we go? Shan't we go? Shall we go? Shan't we go? So we did, and I turned up here August 2021 with a 15 and 16 year old. My eldest was at university. That was interesting.
I
it was hot. All of those things.
August.
And then. It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy making friends. It wasn't easy. You know, I'd always lived in my little, you know, bubble of a village in the UK.
You had your people.
Yeah. So it was a tricky time. It was a tricky time. I was, I think, at the time as well, going through the perimenopause.
With teenage daughters in the house. What fun for everybody.
Yeah. Teenage daughters. New country, back of a pandemic, you know, and gosh. Suddenly I got here and I felt like I lost my identity a bit, you know. In London, I was always Melissa from the Royal Opera House, and here I was, Melissa, Andy's wife. And I love being married to Andy, and I love Andy, but
there's a lot more going on.
There was a lot more going on, it's taken me a couple of years, really. I started singing here, which has been great, doing some corporate events, do some lovely things, which is really great to still sing on, you know, when I want to, which is lovely. But I felt that I was missing something. And then I started, you know, I just started looking at what was different in my life. What was I missing in my life? And I was missing more singing. And then I started thinking, why was I missing singing? What was I missing about it? And I then started researching all the benefits of singing and I was thinking, all of these things, when I sang every day, I just took them for granted.
Can you tell us, can you outline?
Yes. I mean, there's so many. There's so many. I mean, you know, as you said when we started, you know, why do we sing along to the radio? Why do we sing in the shower? Why do we, when we're on the dance floor with friends, why do we sing? We sing because it makes us feel good.
Yeah.
You know, singing makes you feel good.
And there's something about being kind of joined in song. So
yeah.
Being surrounded by people that are singing
yes.
is not exactly the same thing, but when those voices come together.
Absolutely. So when we sing on our own, and when we sing together, when we sing on our own, you know, when you sing, you breathe deeper. So already, immediately, you're increasing the blood flow through your body, the oxygen through your body. Your brain is encouraged to release endorphins, making you feel good. Not only does it make you feel good, you know, that increased oxygen flow, you know, it helps to reduce your blood pressure, your heart rate, generally make you feel calmer.
Interesting.
So it's brilliant, you know, for just to learn how to breathe properly. Is brilliant for everyday stressful situations.
I was about to say, so not just singing, but presumably if you are, I mean, as we are now, speaking, but if people are presenting,
absolutely.
You know, that kind of confidence and presence and connection to self.
Yes, and to learn how to use your whole voice. And to not, you know, it's very easy when you don't know how to sing or to speak. You would think everyone knows how to sing, everyone knows how to speak. We do it every day. But if you're doing it a lot and you don't use your whole body to connect and to get the airflow properly flowing and properly engage your core and everything, you become vocally tired very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Just, I'm sure that, you know.
Oh, I know, babe. So you are on a bit of a mission then after the summer to bring together some people for a series of workshops on exactly this.
Yes.
We should be very clear, it's not a choir.
It is absolutely not a choir. That was the other thing. As I said, there's lots of choirs here and they're amazing. And I've been to some fabulous concerts here. There's a lot of fantastic singing teachers here, one-to-one singing. It's not something that I wanted to do. I want to bring the joy of singing to people who have not experienced it or have experienced it, but have then their life has taken another turn. Maybe they were told in the school choir, actually, could you be quiet a bit? Because actually you're not singing the right notes. You know, there's none of that happening.
So no auditions.
There will be no auditions. There is no music. There is no word sheets. What we're going to work on, as well as the breathing, we're going to work on the other brilliant thing that singing is brilliant for is mental alertness. Brilliant for enhancing your memory, for improving your concentration.
That's exactly what I was just
your
thinking.
Cognitive function.
We were talking earlier this week about Alzheimer's, and Dr. Mona was sitting just there, and she was talking about building your cognitive reserve. And I was like, well, okay, well, so what do you mean? You know, I do a daily word puzzle. She's like, no, it's about shaking things up and learning new things.
Absolutely.
And kind of, you know, adding different things into the mix. And that's exactly what I was thinking there about learning techniques, but also, you know, some new neural pathways going
and
on.
And also learning things. The other thing that was great, so I've done a couple of trial sessions. The first session, I invited lots of my friends. And of course, they were all lovely and really encouraging. And then the second session, I was like, can you send me people who, you know, can you spread the word? And I had a lot of people who I didn't know, which was also amazing, because then I got proper, real feedback, not just kind feedback.
What's it like? What's going to look like in practice, do you think?
So the sessions look like, so we would start with breathing, talk about breathing, deeper breathing, calming breathing, slowing breathing, the connection of your of breathing with your speaking. Mm. I'd take you seamlessly from speaking to singing without even realizing that you're making the transition. We do some cognitive games, so music games, rhythm games to improve your cognitive functions.
That
it's very,
really,
very funny when we all get it wrong, including me.
Good to know.
It's a lot of fun. Yes.
I've had a message you might find interesting here. No name on this one, saying, my professor at a university in Norway had a double PhD, one in classical music and the other in mathematics. We didn't understand the connection until we took a course in modelling of vibrations, impact of winds and water on structures like bridges and high-rise buildings. Music makes you detect the tiniest details. Isn't that beautiful?
I know, it's fascinating. That's beautiful.
Gosh,
yes.
That's so lovely. We've run out of time. I haven't got the Traviata to play for you, but Milani's actually found me a clip of you.
Oh, has she? Which one?
Memory Cats.
Okay,
can I play it?
Yes, of course.
I'm so happy.
But can we tell people what my course is called?
Yes.
Release Your Inner Diva, and it's to empower women through their all sorts of things. It's just come and sing and have fun, meet new people. There'll be coffee and refreshments afterwards. Time to connect. Everything. So
that was my last question to you. How best to get in touch and sign up? And when's it all starting,
you
Melissa?
You can find me on my Instagram, Melissa Alder Soprano. Also, hopefully you're going to start seeing my flyers popping up on all your on all your networks. Hopefully people will start sharing them. But the best way is through my Instagram.
We'll make it even easier. If you want to send me the word sing or some musical note emojis, I will send you Melissa's Instagram so you can find out more. And I'm so happy. I wanted to ask you to sing on air, but I know it's a bit more complicated than that. 4001 with the word sing. I will send you Melissa's details. And here she is in action.
Not a sound from the pavement. Has the moon lost her memory? She is smiling alone. In the lamplight, the withered leaves collect at my feet, and the wind
my gosh, goosebumps galore. Melissa Ulder, thank you so, so much for your time. Wonderful to have you here. And yeah, you might see me for some of those workshops for a bit of a sing, but more to do with the breathing and the speaking, I think, if that sounds good to you.
I hope so, Helen. Please, please do come. Thank you so, so much for inviting me in. It's
my
been absolutely lovely.
Pleasure.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Great to have you with us this Thursday afternoon. All through the week, we've been rounding up some of our favourite camps for kids and seeking out some of the more unique ones. I have been saying cool camps, but I think that's really what I'm talking about today, because Ski Dubai is welcoming some little skiers and adventurers over the summer months. And Philippa Kevin with us now to explain a little bit more. Your office is in Ski Dubai, Philippa, but yet you seem very, well, non-alpine in your wardrobe choice today. You're not working from the snow.
Yeah, not working in the snow today.
What an amazing office. How is really, yeah. Really awesome. Now, Ski Dubai, as we know, I've spent a lot of time in Ski Dubai because when I was training to climb some mountains, I was there at 7 o'clock in the morning going up and down that slope. And for us, it's an absolute go-to at Christmas. And I know a lot of people use it, of course, for recreation, but also training for their ski trips. Over the summer, is there a better place to be when it comes to escaping the heat? I think not. Tell us a little bit about what's happening with the summer camps. Do the kids need to know how to ski, and what else is going to be happening during the day?
Of course, yeah. So we have our summer camps running now until the 30th of August for kids aged between 4 and 12 years. They run Monday to Friday. And we have the option of either a one-day camp or a full week camp as well. Now, they're jam-packed, full of so many different activities. Now, one of them is, as you mentioned about skiing, that introduction to snow sports as well. So it doesn't matter whether you have, your child has been skiing multiple times before, or if it is their first time. We cater to all of those different kind of skill levels in there. So that's obviously kind of one part of it. But in addition to that as well, we obviously have access to the snow park with all of the different rides. There's also the educational penguin program as well. So kids will be able to meet our resident king and gentoo penguins, learn a lot more about those. Plus, obviously, more fun other fun activities as well. So face painting, games, and also team building activities as well. Also, as part of that, all of the lunch and snacks throughout the day are included as part of it as well. So it's a really fully encompassing, kind of day or week camp for the kids. Yeah.
We've had a number of questions during the course of the week looking for camps that are more than just a few hours, to be honest. And I think that it's kind of addressing the struggles and the juggles of working parents. Can I ask what the hours are, Philippa, at the Ski Dubai camp?
Yeah, so it's from 9 a.m. in the morning till 5 p.m. Oh. So that's why we're kind of catering for those mums and dads that are still working, and the other kids can be dropped off for the full day.
And now, as someone who was making packed lunches at 6:45 this morning, the food, the provided food aspect, very welcome indeed. What about the gear? Because yeah. I think a lot of people go, okay, you know, do we need to be providing our own ski gear, snow boots, all that kind of stuff? How does that work?
No, not at all. No, it's the same with any of our kind of activities that we have at Ski Dubai. We provide all of the boots, clothing, warm clothing for kids and adults alike anyway, gloves, hats and things like that. So no, that is all included as part of those summer camp activities.
Now, you're obviously based there at Mall of the Emirates. Is the opportunity to get out of Ski Dubai and do some exploring there? How do you manage to keep all those little skiers kind of together?
Yeah. Well, we actually have, as part of the program as well, visits to Vox Cinema, so where they can go and see some of the kids' movies, and also Magic Planet as well. So it's a full encompassed day. They're not just in the cold snow side for the entire day. It's lots of different interactions, whether it's in the snow, in our party rooms, and as I say, visits to Vox Cinema and Magic Planet as well.
I'm sure it's been incredibly popular for all of the reasons you've just been discussing. What's availability like between now and the end of August?
So we still have some availability. Our week camps are proving the most popular at the moment. I think, well, as you were mentioning previously, with parents still being at work, mm-hmm. it's a lot easier for them to drop the kids from Monday to Friday. And as well, when we have activities that are included, like the ski lessons and introduction to snow sport, it's the growth and the learning aspect as well for kids for skiing over that entire week mm-hmm. and the levels that they manage to grow skiing. It's kind of really important for the parents as well. But no, we still have some availability left. So families can get booking for their kids to join the summer camps at ski.
Can I ask then, and I think you're absolutely right, you know, with kids, they learn so quickly. And I'm sure by the end of those 5 days, some of those kids will be ready, you know, to hit the slopes. How does that work with kind of progressing their learning throughout the week? Are they kind of locked into a kind of a category as such, or can they kind of progress if they are showing natural aptitude?
Yeah, exactly. So we have the different sessions based on their skill level. So depending on the number of the kids that we have in the camp, they'll be split in the various different lessons. But yeah, there's absolutely the potential for them to be able to grow. And again, the instructors, you know, these are professional instructors that we have at Ski Dubai, and they're able to notice those that are advancing slightly faster, say, than others. So there's the scope and the room for those to definitely grow during that week period. Yeah.
Best way of getting in touch, and just remind me one more time, if you don't mind, of the age range and how people can book, Philippa, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. So yeah, the summer camps at Ski Dubai are for children aged between 4 and 12. Best way to book is online at skidxb.com, or they can also visit us on ground at Ski Dubai if they want to find out a bit more information about it as well and chat to the team on ground here. But also that for your listeners in Abu Dhabi, we obviously have Snow Abu Dhabi as well, so, and we also are running summer camps there. So the residents of Abu Dhabi wouldn't be missing out as well. So there's the two options for those.
Philippa, Kevin, massive thanks to you and the team. Sounds like it's all going really, really well so far. And I know a lot of parents listening going, oh, I think the kids would love that, between cinema and snow and some penguins and lunches provided. I think we're doing a great job of bringing some of the best camps around. Philippa, Kevin, thank you. Really appreciate it. Have a fantastic summer.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Throughout the week, and I think next week as well, because we've found some fantastic ones, we are rounding up some of the coolest camps around. We were appropriately talking about Ski Dubai earlier, but if your kid is more of a sewer than a skier, then you need to meet Maria. Joining us now from Threadwork, just over the road in JLT. It's a fantastic sewing studio for grown-ups and kids who are going to be teaching them some new skills over the summer break. Maria, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me, Helen.
My pleasure. Before we get onto the camp, tell us a little bit about how you got into sewing, and I guess have now built your life and career around this.
Yes. So I started off back in Malaysia. So we lived on a small island just off the coast of Brunei, and I didn't have much to do because it's living on an island, and that's where I decided I need a hobby. So I thought sewing sounds really interesting, and it kept me busy throughout the days, and that's how my sewing journey basically started.
Do you remember the first thing that you made that you were really proud of?
I remember making a skirt out of some, I don't know, I think fabric from Daiso, and it was too small. I was really chuffed about it, just having it sewn all together. And yeah, I haven't looked back since, and made all kinds of coats and dresses, trousers, bikini, you name it.
Swimwear?
Yes.
That's confidence. I'm not sure. And now it's become, I mean, I learned to sew before I had kids, and I wish I'd kept it up. I really wish I did, because I actually found a little pouch I'd made recently that had a zip in it, and I remember being so proud of putting the zip in, and now I use it for kind of putting my microphones in for my phone. Oh. And it's just so nice to have, yes, this thing of people going, oh, where'd you get that? And like, I made it, actually.
I think that was one of the sentences that everyone is always super proud of when someone especially compliments it and be like, oh my God, you look amazing in this dress. And you're like, well, I made it. I think that's one of the best feelings, and that's also the feeling that the kids or adults that come to our classes mm-hmm. have after they have finished their projects.
It is lovely to think of this idea of mastery, of having something tangible that you have made, and to be able to see you improving at something, you know, to be able to overcome something that maybe would have felt completely insurmountable, you know, a few weeks or months ago, and then have something that you can hold and touch and wear or give to show what you've learned. It is very unique, actually, I have to say, in that sense.
Yes, so it is very niche, and I fully agree with you that that feeling is so amazing. And we have anyone coming that like, oh, this sounds tricky and I can't do this. And then 2-3 hours later, it's all done and they're super chuffed.
So, good. Yeah. So, Maria, tell us a little bit about teaching kids, because that you're working with children from ages 9 and up. Is it all on the machine or are you doing hand sewing, crochet? What's kind of in historically, aside from the CAM, what historically has really resonated with the younger sewers?
So, yes, we have our classes from 9 years and above, which is for machine sewing. We do have weekly classes after the summer is over for 6, 7, and 8 year olds. And then we do hand sewing. And since the beginning of the year, we have started with crochet as well. And it's a huge hit because I think thanks to social media in one way, they're sharing all the little toys that they're making, and the kids, they're so inspired seeing that, and they want to make that. And since then, our crochet classes have been really popular, and that's what we're teaching as well. The kids, we start off quite easy with, you know, simple stitches like single crochet, just to get a little bit of crochet lingo in here. But then we also move to more complex projects, which are the toys. And they're really, really popular, and the kids love them. Just, yes. You know, I mean, toys in general is great, but having a handmade toy at home, I think that's an amazing feeling.
Very special. So tell us about the camp. You're running through July and then having a short break and then back again in August. Mm-hmm. How's it working in terms of level of ability? You know, can kids come to you who've literally never sat at a sewing machine before? And what are your goals, I guess, by the time they come to the end of the week?
Absolutely. All the kids that come to our beginner sewing course is beginner level, so you don't have to have any experience. On the first day, we show you how to thread and use the sewing machine, and we always have time for a scrunchie, and all the kids love making scrunchies. And then by the end of the 4 days, so it runs normally from Monday to Thursday, they will have made a tote bag, a drawstring bag, a little swim bag, and as well a little emoji cushion.
That is so their really
first
cool.
Little soft toy.
That is really, really cool. And it's a few hours throughout the day, is that right? Would you mind explaining the breakdown? Because I know I'm going to get messages on 4001.
Yeah, sure. So it normally runs for 2 hours, so from Monday to Thursday. For instance, next week we have it from 10 a.m. till 12 p.m. And yeah, so that's the two hours for the 4 days.
Can we do a grown-up camp where we can just sit around and gossip for a few hours a day and make a cushion in a tote bag, Mira? I think that sounds absolutely lovely. What's the best way to book, I guess, is my last question to you. People listening going, oh my goodness, my kid would actually love that. And I think it's a nice way of meeting people as well. You know, I found that with my kids sewing or doing or crafting, they really yes. open up. Like, they really seem to connect over craft.
Yes, we finished our first class this morning, and there's two girls. They were like chatting away and comparing their emojis, and it's just so sweet how they also connect with mm-hmm. each other and share and even help each other. Mm-hmm. So yes, booking. We have a website where we take all our bookings, but of course you can also message us through various channels, social media, email. And we're always there.
Tell you what, if you want to send me the word sew or sewing or the thread emoji, I will send you the Instagram for Threadwork. Maria, thank you so, so much. Really appreciate your time. Get back to your machine and I'll see you on social. It sounds like a fantastic camp and a really, really unique one for the creative kids out there. Have a good summer.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.